Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm Jeff Harris, and this is normally where Daniel Christensen would say, and he's Dan Christensen, but he's not here this week. Instead, as promised last episode, we're once again with my sister, Jillian Venters.
Hi!
So, the reason Jill is gone this episode is she has gone off on adventures down south in the strange and mystical land of California.
Woo!
And we're going to talk about that. But first, let's touch a base on a couple of things that have happened in geek culture that I want to get out of the way before we get into the fun stuff.
Look at you. You have notes.
Yeah, well.
That's good.
What it comes down to, it's yet another episode of convention staffs behaving badly.
Again?
Yeah.
I don't like this game.
No, it's not a fun game. It makes us sad.
It does.
So the first one is, are you familiar with South by Southwest?
Yes. Oh, I read about this. The panels being canceled unilaterally because
yes.
Anything that looks like it might stir up Gamergate.
Basically, what happened was they had two panels, one on harassment in gaming culture, and another, I don't think it was related much, except that I think both panels had a common panelist. But there were threats of violence from factions that, let's be honest, it was the Gamergate factions and related parties threatened violence if these panels happened, and South by Southwest caved. I mean, just completely caved.
Well, threats of violence. I hate to say that they need to cave to that, but what I know of South by Southwest, they don't have the infrastructure in place to deal with that sort of threat if something, heaven forbid, happened.
It still comes down to you let the bad guys win.
It sends the wrong message, absolutely, but when you're looking at the safety of people, I don't know what else they really could have done.
Although, I'm trying to think of a time Gamergate has actually followed through on a threat of violence.
It only takes once.
That's true. But, yeah, and of course, the panelists that were coming just for that panel, they're not getting any refunds on their airfare or anything like that. So, yeah. Now, and that's out there. The other one that happened, and that I just heard about today, and it's a case of somebody must have decided, oh, South by Southwest, we can be so much worse than you.
That's not a bar to aim for.
So, World Fantasy Convention.
Oh, I read about this too. Their anti-harassment policy.
Harassment policy. So, in the last couple of years, we've seen great strides in conventions creating very well done, very comprehensive, very effective harassment policies. Emerald City Comic Con, New York City Comic Con, Dragon Con, all these conventions have been creating really well thought out, comprehensive harassment policies, and then they've enforced them.
And that's what needs to be done.
And it's worked great. It is sending a message that harassment is not accepted. And yes, we still see harassment in the culture, but it is more and more being treated as not what you do, and the conventions have been cracking down.
It's becoming an aberration instead of the accepted norm.
Yeah. Well, World Fantasy Convention released their policy, I guess it was yesterday? I want to say, I saw a lot of news on it today, but I think the actual announcement was yesterday. And their policy comes down to, unless you have to call the police, don't bother us.
World Fantasy Con is one of the last bastions of old guard SF fantasy fandom. It is where a lot of the kids today and their newfangled vidding and cosplay and a lot of those complaints and old man yelling at clouds sort of stuff have come from that convention because they have not yet really caught up with or embraced the cultural zeitgeist as it changes. So as much as I would like to say I am surprised by that being their harassment policy. I'm not. I wish I was.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, there was this whole thing about, well, you know, looking at legal definitions of harassment. Yep. And it really comes down to, we don't want to bother.
Again, this is a massive generalization on my part. It is where a lot of the old white guys of fandom have congregated, and it's never been a problem for them, so why should they have to deal with this?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
So I know that a lot of prominent voices in the community, John Scalzi, just yeah. tore him a new one, and I read a piece very similarly from David Gerald.
Good.
You know, the strong voices in the community for inclusion and safety are not happy. I mean, Scalzi said, well, I'm never going then.
Good.
Well, it doesn't fit his policy of going to a convention with a well-thought-out harassment policy.
Right.
I mean, this is almost the antithesis of a well-thought-out harassment policy.
Oh, no, it sounds like they thought about it.
Well, they thought about it. They just
don't want to be bothered.
Yeah, they just don't want to do anything. So, yeah, it's just, it's sad that it's certainly not going to do anything for their rep.
No, it's not.
And that's, but like you said, it's that old guard. It's not like Worldcon. I mean, I know they want to say, it's weird because locally, I always think of the old guard convention being Norwestcon. And Norwestcon adopted a comprehensive harassment policy after a lot of voices raised up. I was actually one of them.
Yes.
I attended the meeting that had the community feedback on the policy that directly led to Norwestcon adopting a policy basically very similar to what Emerald City and SakuraCon use. And yeah, I mean, that's our local old men shout at clouds. And even they are like, nope, we got to stay with the times. If we want the convention to thrive, you know, new generations have to come in.
Exactly. And if new generations don't feel safe going to that convention or don't feel like their concerns are going to be listened to, then they're not going to go. And we'll see a kind of natural selection thing happen.
Yeah. So that's just what I wanted to cover of, all right, here's what's going on in fandom in general. Now, when this podcast is released, it'll be 2 days after Halloween.
Whee!
Of course, when we're recording it, we're 2 days looking forward to Halloween. So
we're talking to the future! Or something.
Or something. And I think it should be very clear in our family that Halloween is a super big deal.
I got married on Halloween.
She did. It's her wedding anniversary. If nothing else, you'll never forget.
Nope.
That was a fun night.
It was. It was a very fun night. Everyone came in costume, and it was wonderful.
Yes. Some costumes may have been a little on the questionable side, but hey.
It's our friends.
It is. That's true. So with that, of course, everything turns to the spooky. And one of the things that happen is a lot of places will hold Halloween events. I mean, haunted houses
yes.
are a staple around this time of year. I used to work for a local haunted house, and we have friends who still do that kind of thing. Honestly, if the big haunted house wasn't down in Tacoma, I might have tried this year. We have a friend who's working down there.
Oh, is he working down there?
It's Eric Popes.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. I saw him very briefly at the... at the Gothic Witches Ball that I went to on Saturday night with Alex.
Speaking of which, there was things like a Gothic Witches Ball. So that's probably not something you promote as big, but...
But it was fun. It was a nice little event.
Yeah. However, if we have nice things here in Seattle, Los Angeles just pulls out all the stops.
Man, they have all the best things.
And Jill decided to partake of those recently.
Well, Pete decided that we would actually be able to go down to California, visit our friends. We have a couple friends who live down there, one of whom runs a sound design company that does a lot of stuff involved with Halloween. His sound design company is one of the ones that works on Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios. And when we discovered that one of the mazes at Universal Studios for this year's Halloween Horror Nights was going to be Crimson Peak, I ran around the house and flailed a lot, and Pete was like, okay, fine. this means a lot to you. Okay.
So let's talk about the various events you attended, because you didn't just go for Halloween Horror Nights.
No, we went to Halloween Horror Nights. We went to that the day we came into California. So we got off the plane, we went and got food, we dropped off our stuff at Duran Kristen's. We went to Halloween Horror Nights, which was huge and amazing. They were very kind. They treated us to front-of-line passes.
Oh, nice.
Which, let me tell you, if you were going to Halloween Horror Nights, front-of-line passes make the difference between having a good time and being stuck in lines for up to 2 hours. The front-of-line passes let us go straight to front-of-line, and it was, there were mazes where there was a 90-minute wait to get in.
I saw that, like, when I went to the 20th anniversary event in Florida. I remember seeing long lines, and we did not have front-of-line passes. We just endured the night.
Right.
I had a good time. But, yeah, there was a lot of waiting in line.
We had an excellent time. The mazes that we saw, we went on Terror Tram, which was themed for The Purge. We went through the Insidious maze, which, since I have not seen the Insidious movies, I have been assured that that maze was far less terrifying for me than people who have seen the movies.
I can see that. I am familiar with the Insidious movies. I enjoy them quite a bit. But I could see where there could be things in those movies that would have triggered you, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we didn't show them to you.
Yeah, I think that was it. We saw the Walking Dead maze, which is the biggest area maze they've done. It was something like 7,000 square feet.
So how long did that take to walk through?
It took a good 10, maybe 15 minutes to walk through.
Okay, because the normal maze is about, I don't know, 5 to 10.
Yeah, so. this was double the length to walk through than any other maze, excepting Terror Tram, The Purge, which, you know, you walk through part of the back lot.
Right.
There was the newly revamped Halloween maze for Michael Myers, and that was fantastic. There were some great state-of-the-art effects in there. They had a lot of set scenes with actors in them, recreating classic scenes from the movies. That was really well done. Trying to think what else we went. We went through the Crimson Peak maze, which was everything I had hoped for. And very interestingly, it was done as an extended trailer for the movie, so it didn't give any of the plot away. A friend of mine, Drew Rausch, who lives down in LA, he and his wife had gone through the maze, and he texted me and said, yeah, they went through the maze before the movie opened. And he texted me and said, we went through the maze, it's fantastic, still no idea what the movie's about.
See, that's good if you're going to be doing something on based on something that's going to be in the theaters.
Yes.
I know one of the challenges, a couple of years back, one of the mazes was based on Cabin in the Woods.
Right.
And now this was a couple of years after the movie came out, but I know that on that one, there was actually a warning going into the maze that it would spoil the movie.
That would spoil for the movie, yeah. The Crimson Peak maze was fantastic. I would love to be able to walk through that maze with the lights on and without any of the scare actors lunging out at me, because I would just want to be able to look at all the detailing. But all the scare actors, well, I wanted their wardrobes.
What a shock.
And my friend who works on the mazes, he was very surprised that I didn't get yanked and told get back to work. Because my wardrobe was close enough to what they were wearing that, I could see that happening. And then we saw the Alien versus Predator maze, which was my husband's absolute favorite because he's a huge Aliens geek. So
I wouldn't know, considering we're sitting in your living room right now and I'm staring right at an Alien or a Predator bust.
A Predator head, yeah. That's...
Yeah.
Well, Ingrid loves you. But it was... They also had special scare zones that you had to walk through. So there was the Dark Christmas one, which... I'm willing to bet it was a test run for in case they do a Krampus maze.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun. There was a war-themed, like a World War II-themed one. I don't know. There were people in gas masks and antique-looking military uniforms lunging.
Okay.
Whatever. And the opening scare zone, which you had to walk through to get to anything, was the insecticide, where the idea, or the exterminators, which was the idea that insects ruled the world and there were exterminators trying to kill off the humans. It was a variant on the clowns with chainsaws, so whatever.
I'm just trying to reconcile how that becomes a variant, how insect exterminating humans becomes a variant on clowns with chainsaws.
It was much, they had chainsaws and they had scary makeup and they lunged at people and they liked to follow teenage girls around and try and scare them.
So pretty typical for Halloween Horror Nights. Chainsaws are a staple.
They are. One of the things that really amused me about that opening scare zone is because it's also, you walk to where the giant pipe organ that shoots, you know, 20-foot gouts of flame into the sky, which of course I covet deeply on a spiritual level. I need it. You don't understand. We need one in the backyard. You're just giving me that look. Okay.
All I'm thinking is 20-foot gouts of flame.
It was beautiful.
Okay, we generally don't want you to have fire on a day-to-day basis.
I know.
So
irrationally
anyway.
So. But they had a ringmaster character who was on stilts.
Okay.
So a good, you know, 12, 14 feet tall, walking around, lunging after people. And he lunged at me, and I blew him a kiss, because that's what I do to the scare actors at Halloween Horror Nights. And he got all flustered. And then he walked around behind our group and came up on the other side of me and offered me his hand, and then proceeded to parade me through the scare zone. And at the end of it, gave me a little twirl and then wandered off.
Of course he did.
He was very sweet.
Well, you know. It's like, oh, the Queen's visiting.
It was nice.
So.
But in addition to the Halloween Horror Nights, we went to Wicked Lit, which our friend from the sound design company, Diablo Sound, has helped produce for years. They've been trying to get us to come down to this forever. And having seen it now, I understand why. It's a theatrical production where there are three plays based off of classic Gothic literature, and it's a round robin sort of thing. The audience is broken up into three groups, and everyone will see each production, but you'll see it in a different order from the other groups. And it's set at a historic cemetery. It's set at Mountain View Cemetery. And two of the productions are done inside the historic mausoleum.
Now, is this the audience moves?
Yes, the audience moves, not the productions.
Okay.
You know, between each production, you are brought back to the center staging area, and there was a fourth production, the staging production, The System, which was based off an Edgar Allan Poe story, and it's the idea of this is an asylum, and the head doctor has come up with this system to let the inmates explore their insanity and their issues through creating art. And so that each play you go to is one of the inmates' stories. But we were very lucky in that our group, the order we saw things in, we saw The Ebony Gate, which was a great ghost story. We saw The Grave of Rashomon, which is a wonderful Asian production, which was beautifully done. But the final one we saw was Fall of the House of Usher in the mausoleum, where we had to walk around and go to different rooms in the mausoleum. And it's full professional. This is a professional thing. It's professional actors, professional lighting, professional sound. It was amazing. It was the best thing we'd seen. And I am not surprised that this is one of the hot tickets for LA Halloween. It sells out every year. I mean, it's a small audience size. It's only, you know, maybe 60, 70 people per night.
Okay.
So that was just fantastic. If we go back down in October again, we will definitely make sure to go see Wicked Lit again, because it was fantastic. In upcoming years, any of you who are in the California area who are able to go to Wicked Lit, I highly recommend it. It was probably the standout event we went to, which is saying a lot, because the other event we went to was at Disneyland. We went to Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party.
And how was that?
It had a couple factors working against it just environmentally, because I apparently brought part of Seattle weather with me down there, so it was very humid and kind of overcast, and then the night of the Halloween party we were there, there was this huge torrential cloud burst that we missed because we were inside the Haunted Mansion. Go figure. But it soaked everything enough, and there was enough, the ground was slick enough that they canceled the parade.
Now, I understand. That's understandable. I
mean, yeah, that was completely understandable.
I have heard that Main Street is, in fact, prone to flooding.
Yes, we actually saw some people with brooms trying to sweep away water into their gutter system. So yeah. I am not surprised. And my husband missed part of the fireworks just because of some environmental things that were happening. He had to call home for something.
Right.
But the fireworks were great. And the big thing for us, and the main reason we decided to get the tickets, because it is a separate ticketed event
right.
for Disneyland, is because It is a separate ticketed event. The park is at a much lower capacity.
All right.
So there was only a 20-minute wait to get onto the Haunted Mansion.
Now, is the entire park open, or is it limited, like, just a couple lands?
They closed Toontown for the fireworks.
That's normal procedure, though.
Right. But other than that, it's all of Disneyland.
Okay.
And there were opportunities to go see different characters. They pipe in, you know, Halloween-themed music. There's trick-or-treating, which I didn't bother going through any of the trick-or-treating stations because Pete was like, you do not need extra sugar. Oh my God, there's a peep station. Dear God, no. Because when I get a lot of sugar in me, I get a lot like a five-year-old, and my husband understandably did not want to deal with that.
Just you know, folks, she's telling you that. I already know this.
Yes.
I have lived this.
You have given me pixie sticks, much to Pete's dismay. But kids trick-or-treat, grown-ups trick-or-treat, it's one of the few times adults are allowed in costume in the park.
Right.
So that was a big deal. Seeing the various villains around was nice, but the line to get your photo taken with any of the villain characters was ridiculous. We looked at it and was like, okay, either I can stand in line and get my photo taken with these characters, or we can go do other things in the park.
Right.
Let's go do other things in the park.
Well, for a lot of people, those villain photo ops are one of the main reasons they do it. I mean, that's... Yes. Everything I've ever read about the event talks about the villains and the photos.
We saw the carriage go by that had the Evil Queen, Cruella de Vil, and Maleficent in it.
Okay.
And I squeaked and lost my tiny little mind, and there was flailing hands, and Clovis Devilbunny and I were very excited. And Pete was like, they're leaving. You can't go crash their carriage. We saw Hades. We saw Captain Hook. We saw Jack Skellington. The line to get your photo taken with Jack Skellington and Sally was crazy, which is why we don't have any photos like that.
Right.
There's fog piped in over the Great Lake of America, mm-hmm. the Rivers of America, the Dapper Dans, which is the barbershop quartet for the Halloween party, are the Cadaver Dans. And, you know, they sing all the villain songs. And we were very lucky. We were staying at the Grand Californian Hotel. And one before the Halloween party, like a couple hours beforehand, we walked back into the hotel to go drop off our stuff, go find some place to have dinner. And the Cadaver Dans were up on one of the balconies in the lobby singing. So we got to catch their performance there, which was amazing.
And just for keeping account, how many times did you go on Haunted Mansion that night?
Oh, that night?
Yeah.
Just that night, not including the day during the day and the evening before. So just that night?
Yeah, just that night, and then we'll get the rest.
Okay, just that night, we only went through twice.
Okay. And the entire trip?
The entire trip was six. It okay. would have been more, but one of the times we were in line on Monday during the day, they closed the mansion. They had technical difficulties to the point where they cleared the queue, and they locked the gates.
Interesting.
So, and I'm assuming that whatever happened, they were like, okay, we have to close it down and get everything ready for tonight, because having the mansion closed for the Halloween party would have been ridiculous.
Yeah, that would have probably resulted in riots.
Yes. And of course, because it's Haunted Holiday, it was the Nightmare Before Christmas overlay, which every year, just from what I understand, gets bigger and bigger.
Now, you've seen it before, right?
I've seen it before, and it was much more elaborate than the time I had been. But the last time I'd been was a good 8 years ago.
Right, where I was there, like, 3 years ago on my honeymoon.
Right.
Right.
And they had a giant scarecrow of Jack right in front of the mansion, right by one of the walkways, which I gather some of the cast members were not terribly thrilled with because it was a bottleneck for lines, because people would stop to take a photo of themselves with the scarecrow in the background. And of course, everyone's stopping, everyone's taking a photo. It's blocking the lines, you know, adding to the wait time to get to the mansion. Mm-hmm. The part where you usually see Master Gacy hanging in the elevator room,
right,
now has an animation
of that
ceiling breaking and Jack and Zero peering through.
Because when I saw it, it was just they had replaced Gacy with just a big Jack face.
No, now it's an animation, and it's
nice.
Zero flying around and Jack saying Happy Halloween and Happy Merry Christmas, everyone.
Well, that lines up with the last couple of years, them adding more elements like that into the rides in general.
Yes. The hallway with all the changing portraits that you walk through before you get to the doom buggies, those were all animated.
Okay.
Zero would fly from portrait to portrait and then change them from what they were to their spooky holiday counterparts.
Interesting.
So that was neat.
So that's definitely a technology upgrade.
They increased the amount of gingerbread and caramelized sugar smell in the ballroom, okay, where they have the gingerbread house in the centerpiece of the table.
All right. And of course, the big question, the Hatbox Ghost.
The Hatbox Ghost had a lovely hat ornament of holly leaves and stripy ribbon and skulls on his hat, mm-hmm, and around him were other holiday hats.
Oh.
So there was a Santa hat, there was an elf hat, there was like a red and green top hat.
Did they replace the bride?
They replaced the bride entirely. They completely, the attic portion where the bride usually is instead where all the presents are. Okay. And there's the snake that arches over the doorway that leads you to the graveyard. And it's eating presents.
Okay. So, all right. It's always interesting to hear how they're upgrading these things. I'm expecting some big upgrades maybe in the next couple of years to the ghosts that follow you home.
Oh, I would think so. Oh, that was one of the other things. So the ghosts that follow you home, mm-hmm, for the haunted holiday, it's Oogie Boogie spinning a wheel and seeing what magical surprise you get, be it, you know, sticks of dynamite or candy cane snakes or whatever. But Lock, Shock, and Barrel would pop up in the windows, oh, too.
So they've replaced the hitchhiking ghosts with Oogie Boogie.
Yes.
That's also new since the last time I saw the overlay.
Yeah, that's one of the things they do for the holiday overlay.
That's a nice touch.
And the little, instead of having the little bride at the end saying, hurry back, is Sally.
Okay.
We're saying a poem about hurry back, be sure to bring your Santa Claus sack. And
nice. Anything else memorable in the park for the Halloween season?
They've got the giant Mickey Mouse jack-o'-lantern at the center of Main Street, which was amazing. It was a good, mm-hmm, it was a good 20 feet tall. It was huge. They have, of course, Halloween decor all over the park. So there's jack-o'-lanterns hanging from the lampposts. There's giant inflatable ghost balloons. They change some of the colors that go over the castle during the evening.
Nice.
They add in some more purple and some more green, and they do some orange.
I wonder, I know you probably didn't, well, you might have seen the outside. I'm sure you didn't go in. What about It's a Small World? Because they usually will do some interesting projections or decorations.
We didn't even go near It's a Small World, so I cannot answer that question for you.
Pete is still holding that trauma near
and
dear.
We started to veer towards it, and he was like, what's this way? And I said, It's a Small World, and we turned the opposite direction immediately. So
wow.
And it looked like Space Mountain had something called the Ghost Galaxy.
Oh, yeah. We
saw a sign for that, but of course we did not go on Space Mountain.
So my understanding of that is that the universe projection, especially that top before you go over, that they do have like a spectral image, like a ghost figure at the top. And I think he even has a name, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. But yeah, I have heard they do this thing, the Ghost Galaxy. If I'm ever there around the Halloween season, I would definitely want to see what that is.
He's explaining this to you people because the few times I have been tricked and or convinced to go on Space Mountain, my eyes are closed. I have no idea what any of the things in there are like. It's just really fast and it turns and I scream.
You know, you were only tricked on it once. The other times were your choice.
I make bad choices sometimes. So,
and still no going on Twilight Zone Tower of Terror.
No, I don't care what you say family honor demands. I do not believe family honor demands I go on that ride. Also, when the day we were in California Adventure, we had been walking around LA for 3 days already. Mm-hmm. And I was not up to waiting in a 90-minute queue, because that's how long it was from Tower of Terror, to just then take the last panic exit out.
Right.
I didn't feel it. Maybe the next time I go to Disneyland on my very first day, I will go to California Adventure, and I will do the walkthrough of the queue so I can see all the theming, and then bolt, because there is no way I am getting on a ride that drops how many stories?
Only two or three.
I don't care, no.
So, you told me a story right when you got back and we had dinner. I don't know if you want to share it here, but about a ride you went on that matched your your inadvertent getting on exciting rides.
So motif. I am not a roller coaster person in the slightest. I do not like the sensation of falling. The dip you take at the beginning of Pirates of the Caribbean makes me shriek a little bit every time, even though I know it's coming. So I'm not a roller coaster person. And we were in California Adventure. We were there with our friend Drew. Someone turned around and saw my husband and Drew and I and said, "Hey, there are three of you. Do you guys want fast passes for Radiator Springs?" And we said, "Sure." And they gave us the fast passes. And we looked and we're like, "Oh, it's right now. Okay, we need to go over there." So we go tootling over there. It's the Cars themed ride. So we're going through the fast pass line. We're standing there and these cars go hurtling overhead really fast. And I look up and I'm like, And Drew goes, no, it's fine, it's fine. It just goes really fast. There are no real dips or anything. And I said, okay. So we get on the ride, and you go through some of the dark ride part where, you know, you have to avoid a combine harvester and a train and a bunch of other stuff. And then you go into the tire store, and they give your car white wall tires. And then you pull out, and you are next to another one of the cars for the ride. So it's you and another group of people, and there's going to be a race. Okay, fine. Going to be a race. Things start accelerating, and then there's a dip, and then it gets really fast, and then you're turning on curves at a 45-degree angle, and I start screaming, and apparently I did manage to scream the words, "You lied to me!" while we were zipping around things. And, yeah, apparently it's a really tame roller coaster type ride, unless you're me, and unless you're not warned. And that is horrifying.
I'll have to check that out. I actually didn't go on that last time I was there.
I can see where, if you know what is going on ahead of time, and you are someone who can handle the 45-degree turns, it would be great.
All right.
But it's that sensation of falling. I don't like it.
Okay. So, to sum up your adventures in California, it sounds like best thing was Wicked Lit.
Wicked Lit was far and away the best thing. It was so amazing.
And then Halloween Horror Nights.
Probably Halloween Horror. Well, Halloween Horror Nights and Disney tied.
Okay.
Equally tied. Because while I love Halloween Horror Nights and I love going through the scare mazes, I do have a certain threshold for, okay, I am done with actors lunging out at me.
Okay.
Trying to make me jump. There comes a certain point where I'm like, I'm totally done with this. The terror tram for the maze, or not the maze, the Purge, made it look very interesting. I might be interested in actually watching the movies now, which before I had no interest, so props to them.
Now, they let you out and I've never been to Hollywood Halloween Horror Nights, so they let you out at the Bates Motel?
No, you end up walking up and around past the Bates Motel, so they let you out before that.
Okay.
You go through a whole scare zone.
Okay, so they let you out before the basement, so you walk up past, so you walk through Amityville, for the Jaws section. All right.
And basically the last thing, you exit the scare zone right before the Bates Motel, and they were doing photo ops at the Bates Motel.
Okay, so you're going the other direction.
You're going the other direction.
Interesting, so they probably let you out around where the plane crash set is.
Yes, and that's one of the things you walk through.
Okay, so that would make sense. So I'm used to how the tram goes, where it starts at the Bates Motel and then goes up. So you're going the other direction.
It reverses it.
I can kind of see that for the Purge, though. That works, because that wreckage creates a lot of places for people to hide.
Yes.
And their houses on that set.
Yes.
And then you have to go past the Bates Motel, or the Bates House.
And they did a really interesting thing with it while you're on the tram. The arcing story for that was that you are all in the tram to go to a safe location for a purge party where you are, you know, going to be safe from the activities of the purge, and there's fun for the whole family, and there will be snacks, and there's kittens and puppies and arts and crafts for the kids. And then right as the tram stops, the announcer lady who has been talking to you about it says, "Okay, are we there? Great. Get out. I hope they kill every last one of you."
Nice.
So that was well done.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
So any recommendations for anyone who's traveling down for these events? Just any hints, any tips you can give anyone?
Oh my God, bring comfortable shoes. I thought I brought comfortable shoes, and no, not for the amount of walking I was doing.
Well, that's always a challenge.
It is. Be aware that there are going to be lines. Mm-hmm. And more so than usual, because before Mickey's Halloween party, just during the regular time of the park, the lines were huge because people who were not staying for the party were there trying to get everything done.
Right.
And if you're going to Halloween Horror Nights, you know, plunk down the extra money and get the front of line passes. It was totally worth it.
Okay. Cool. So, I guess the next natural thing for us to discuss, since we've teased it already, is Crimson Peak has come out.
Movie of my heart! Oh my god! It was everything I wanted.
And so we've both seen it.
Yes. Twice! For me.
So I think right now is a good time as any to do a review of Crimson Peak. Of course, we're going to avoid any spoilers, although I will say this. As somebody who is familiar with Gothic literature and Gothic romance, I think anyone who is familiar with Gothic literature and Gothic romance is going to know exactly what the story is going to do.
Yes. If you are familiar with the tropes and the narrative beats of Gothic romance, especially of supernatural Gothic romance, and I'm not talking about the current incarnations of it, I'm talking the classics, there are no surprises. Everything that is telegraphed in the trailer is paid off in the movie.
On the other hand, it has been so long since anyone has done anything with Gothic romance.
I know!
That I think it does still become somewhat surprising to people because they're not used to the structure, which Guillermo del Toro followed lavishly.
Yes, he followed very faithfully. It was beautifully done. One of the things that made me a little sad, actually, is the marketing for the movie was really pushing it as a horror film, as a scary ghost story.
What?
And it's a Gothic romance with ghosts and with some really messed up family dynamics.
Well, I think the problem there is and I think Del Toro's had this problem in the past. He's a smart filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
He tends to make smart films.
Yes.
Or I guess it's better to say Guillermo del Toro does not talk down to his audience.
No.
And the problem is the marketing machine is so used to lowest common denominator that when you're dealing with something that has more complexity and more layers like Crimson Peak, it's, well, how do we market? What type of movie is this? And the only thing they could latch onto is, well, there's ghosts in it, so let's make it a horror movie.
One of the things that I found really interesting between my two viewings of it, because I saw it the Saturday after it came out, and then I saw it just again this past Sunday, and in between that, I have looked at The Art of Darkness, The Making of Crimson Peak book, and I've read the movie novelization. And those two things add so much more depth and nuance to the layers of the story that the second time I viewed it, there were things I knew to look for. There were things I definitely knew to keep an eye out for as recurring motifs, as sly nods to the genre in the background scenery, stuff like that. And this is a movie that will just improve upon rewatch. There's so much there to tease out and to look at. One of the things, which is not a spoiler at all, is when they get to Allerdale Hall, when they get to the ancestral home, the wallpaper in the house, not only is it a moth motif,
right?
It spells out the word fear in the moth's wings.
Really?
Yes.
Nice. That's a nice subtle touch. I mean, the moth motif is throughout the movie, which is sad for our friend Michael Montour, who is the co-host of Don't Read the Latin, because he reacts to moths much the way you react to spiders.
When we got out of the movie on the Saturday night that we went and saw it in L.A., I pulled out my phone and I started texting, and Pete was like, "Who are you texting?" I said, "I'm texting Six to warn him." And he kind of looked at me and he said, "Why are you warning him?" I said, "Because he has the same phobia about moths that I do about spiders. And I need to let him know what to be aware of going into this film. Because there are moths everywhere." Yeah. And I told him, if you do manage to see it, you need to skip the end credits.
Yeah.
Because close-ups of moths. And Michael would not deal well with that.
No.
But there's so many layers of narrative structure going on, even in terms of color choices for the costumings and the costume and design of the costumes and some of the actual decisions made on how the costumes were constructed. I mean, I'm a big costuming nerd, so finding out that information in the art book, I was like, yes, tell me more. I want an entire book on how you designed these costumes. But knowing those layers and how they add to the storytelling, even if you aren't consciously aware of it, it's still there. It's still adding depth to that story.
Nice. And, of course, the performances were incredible.
The performances were wonderful. And it is such a classic gothic romance, but with very importantly with some of the roles inverted.
Right. Because this is the year of the female heroine.
Yes.
And while I don't know that I would put Edith in the same boat with Furiosa, this is a movie where she has agency.
Yes. Oh, very much so.
And in fact, all the female characters, the two main female characters, I should say,
yes,
both have a great deal of agency in this movie.
And again, the novelization is another thing where I would love to see a director's cut of this movie to see how much of the background that's in the novelization was filmed. Because there's so much more information in there. I mean, the film as it on its own stands alone. It's great. It works wonderfully. But because I am the target market for this movie, I was the target market for this movie as soon as it was announced. I have gotten all the merchandise I can get my little hands on. And so the novelization was... There's like five adjectives to every sentence. It is so wonderfully, luridly dripping purple prose. It is the novel, it is the text equivalent of the lushness you see on screen.
So, obviously, since you've called it Movie of Your Heart, so this is, what is your favorite movie this year so far, now that Crimson Peak has come out? Has it taken your number one spot?
It has taken my number one spot, okay. Absolutely. I mean, I am not kidding. I am the target market for this movie. Also, since when this is really going to be released 2 days after Halloween.
So this will be going on the 2nd. If we keep on schedule, this should be releasing on the 2nd.
Which means that the Crimson Peak tie-in line from Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab is live. And there are perfumes, nail polishes, home decor, and jewelry available. I have gotten some of the perfumes as a press kit extra because the kids at BPAL love me. Hi, Beth! And they're wonderful. They're wonderfully lush, nuanced creations that are doing a really good job of capturing the characters in a perfume sense.
Now, was that some of the stuff you were showing me the other night?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, those were some nice... I mean, I'm not...
You're not a perfume guy.
I'm not a perfume guy. I know enough to be able to recognize certain notes,
right,
in the sense. But yeah, although I've always known from your descriptions that Black Phoenix is able to very interestingly create scents that do evoke scenes or characters.
The perfume they've done for Black Moths really does smell like what I would expect a book or a framed collection of moths to smell like. There's a dusty iridescence to it.
Okay. So, anyway, obviously, those of you who haven't seen Crimson Peak yet...
Go see Crimson Peak! Go see Crimson Peak!
But this does lead us into another line of questioning that I did vow once online that the next time I got you on the show, we were going to talk about. And this is... you and Gothic literature.
Oh!
Because of your habit of reading a book and putting out various bits of dialogue or passages of the book on Tumblr. And there was one, I want to say Lord Satan was
Lord in. Satan. I haven't actually quoted any of the lines from Lord Satan yet. I need to set up my cue with that. Lord Satan is one of the infamous Avon Gothic Satanic imprint. Yes, in the early 70s, Avon Publishing had a line of Gothic romance novels that had to do with the supernatural and were under the imprint a Gothic Satanic and has a little Baphomet head as the logo. So, you know, cover art of earnest young women in flowing nightgowns running away from something looming behind them and a tiny Baphomet head up in the corner. They're great. They are of varying quality in terms of writing, but they're all a lot of fun. Most of them do deal with some sort of satanic cult or witches or human sacrifice cults or what have you, but they are again, in that trope of classic Gothic romance literature, where you hit all the narrative high points. You have the earnest young heroine who maybe isn't aware of what is going on, and if only she had known that, you know, her fourth cousin removed, who's decided to come rescue her from her orphanage life and marry her, that the people in the village calling him Lord Satan isn't necessarily a joke.
Because I'm just glancing over to my right, and there I see a lot of
you,
these.
You see all 12 of them. I did manage to finally get all 12.
And Lord Satan right at the top.
Yes, the Lord Satan, A Family Affair, The Sorcerers, When the Century Blooms, The Twisted Tree, The Red Wine of Rapture, Demon Lover. They're great. They're wonderful popcorn books. That's really how I can describe them. There are times when I am too tired, or I am too busy or too stressed to really focus on more in-depth literature, but these are fun and distracting, and they're like, you know, they're like reading an episode of The Addams Family, but with more swooning.
Okay, then. So, now, even though this is coming out after Halloween.
Yes.
This is sort of being wrapped into our Halloween theme month. And I think, and I know you've done stuff online all the time with things like this, but what are some tips you would like to give your followers that are very clearly going to be listening into this episode, and my followers, what tips would you like to give them for just having a great Halloween?
If you are of the spooky persuasion, this is the time of year to hit all the thrift stores, because they save up all the cool, spooky, vintage wear, housewares, whatever, and put it all out now. So this is the time of year we do our shopping. I have scored a couple great velvet jackets at local thrift stores, because they hide them until it's costume time. Hear those air quotes, yeah. If you are going out on Halloween, remember that your all-black outfit, while lovely, is not going to be really visible to cars, so carry a flashlight or a blinky light, or put scotch light reflective tape or something on you, because it's all well and fine being a creature of darkness, getting run over, not so awesome. Keep in mind that when you go to stores, people are going to ask you, oh, your costume! It's great! Where can I get a costume like that? It is perfectly fine to look at them and say, this isn't a costume. Try not to get upset when they ask you if it is. And if you are more of an outgoing extrovert nature and you have the time, feel free to help these people find costume elements. I have helped more small children find spooky witch outfits at the local thrift store, which is awesome. I have fun with that.
And one last thing before we wrap up. A few episodes back, I was trying to explain during one of our segments on convention staffs acting badly. I was trying to explain Lolita culture to Daniel.
Oh, and, that's right.
And it didn't go well, because as soon as I said the word Lolita, he locked in on the Nabokov book.
Right.
And his brain couldn't get out of that.
Right.
And I realized that when he referred to it as the National Man-Girl Love Association, that I had lost any hope of, and I had threatened him that I was going to have you know, explain Lolita culture.
Lolita culture, the Lolita fashion, which came out of Japan, is very much about looking like a frilly doll. It's looking doll-like as possible. Not Barbie doll, but fancy little girl doll. So lots of petticoats, lots of ruffles. It is also about looking pretty without presenting a sexual aspect. It is not inviting. Lolita fashion culture from Japan is not about inviting the male gaze at all. Because most guys I know look at girls in layers of petticoats and ruffles and looking like they should be perched on a shelf in some grandmother's home and kind of go, whoa, no, that's weird. It is much more about a princess doll ideal for women, for girls. And the name is a case of English gone wrong. They latched onto it as a way to describe this innocent doll-like fashion without realizing the larger context that the novel has. So the novel has nothing to do with the fashion. They unfortunately share a name, and that's it. There's no connection between them. Daniel, I'm going to bop you on the nose with a rolled-up newspaper.
That would be interesting to see, especially if we all get together for a year-end.
Yes.
So with that, I think it is a great time to come to an end. Where can people reach you?
People can find me at gothiccharmschool.com, gothiccharmschool.tumblr.com, cupcakegoth on Twitter, cupcakegoth on LiveJournal and DreamWith, Jillian Venters on Facebook. Really, type in Jillian Venters into Google, you'll find me.
And as always, if you want to leave a message for me or the show, you can go to www.fanboynewsnetwork.com and leave us a message in the comment section of this episode. With that, Daniel will most likely be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. Until then, take care.
Have a good night.
This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network and is copyright 2015 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from the Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.